This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the last few months, as the coronavirus has taken hold, there's been a documented rise in reports of racist language and behavior. 1,500 particular reports since March from one organization monitoring these things. And most of those reports were in California and New York, but they've come from 45 states in this country. The Asian American journalist and activist Helen Zia wrote recently that this wave of racism is another virus. That's how she put it, that puts people's lives in danger. But she says it's not new. Helen Zia is featured in a documentary series premiering on PBS stations around the country early next week that explores the Asian American experience. And today in the program, she's joining us to talk about this history and the role that she's played in it over time. Helen Zia's most recent book is Last Boat, Out of Shanghai, the Epic Story of the Chinese Who Fled Mao's Revolution. She's joining us from her home in California. And Helen Zia, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here with you, Doug.
I want to begin, I guess, by getting some impressions. What are you seeing in this rise of what appears to be racist language and stereotypes? We're seeing our own president, of course, who for a time anyway insisted on referring to the coronavirus as the Chinese virus. So just broadly, what are you seeing in all of that?
Well, I have to say, watching this pandemic of racism develop, it has been like watching a slow motion train wreck approaching. And the signs really began before COVID hit the United States. As soon as all the news started rolling, you know, at the beginning of this year in January about this strange virus that was spreading throughout China, of course, it was more of a sort of a curiosity, a distant curiosity to those of us in the States. But Chinatowns, businesses, small businesses, and, you know, the vast majority of Asian Americans are immigrants. Yeah. And so like many immigrant groups who can't get access to working for a big corporation or whatever, there are many small businesses, and that's how immigrants survive. And so suddenly, beginning of this year, many of those businesses started losing 70% of their customers. People weren't going in. Chinatowns, Japantowns, you know, places that feature Asian American food and markets, Koreatowns, you know, Saigons started seeing, you know, becoming almost like ghost towns. And there were a lot of stories about how Asian Americans were being very affected by this and worrying about their livelihoods. Then when the pandemic hit North America, then we started seeing the attacks. And frankly, as soon as the president in the, what I'm sorry I have to call the white supremacy house, as soon as he began pointing the finger at China, which many of us, you know, realize was to deflect from his own incompetency in handling this. As soon as that started happening, that's when the spikes of reported attacks, harassment, bullying, threats, racial slurs, but also attacks where even a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old child were stabbed by somebody who said he hated Chinese because of the virus. And by the way, they were not Chinese Americans. So seeing this build, it has been almost like seeing a bad nightmare of times past when there have been, you know, waves of anti-Asian racism of various forms.
Yeah.
To see this happening now. And it's frightening because, you know, we're only at the beginning. And we know that the pain and suffering that's going to go on throughout all of our communities, including affecting Asian Americans, is you know, it's going to go on for some time. So it's scary.
One of the waves of violence from the not so distant past was that you are intimately involved with, you wrote about as a journalist, you were engaged with as an activist, was the the anti-Japanese violence that happened when the manufacturing sector in the United States collapsed in the 1980s. And one of the things that you said at the time, and I found interesting as I'm sort of looking to connect it to the moment here, is you said that obviously there was this wave of anti-Japanese violence and racism, but it wasn't directed at the Germans. You mentioned Volkswagens were also as popular as Japanese cars were. But you said this. You said racism is a more effective tool when the enemy looks different. Is that what's happening here? Is that what makes it easier to discriminate, I suppose, when there's that really apparent difference?
Oh, Doug, thank you for that question. Without a doubt. The idea of blaming or scapegoating any group is a very effective way of dividing people, of keeping people apart. And for Asian Americans, it really has been a signifier of our whole immigration history to the United States and frankly, elsewhere, when we were largely an agricultural country and migrant, cheap, stoop labor was required, that most of the, you know, local citizens, Americans, didn't want to do that work in the fields. That labor had to be imported. And so plantation owners, even back in the early 1800s and before, you can find historical records where they're saying, oh, let's bring the Chinese and the Filipinos and the Portuguese. They don't get along. This will help keep us divided, you know, keep the workforce divided, and therefore we won't have to worry about people having strikes or whatever. And so that's part of our history. And the auto factories, talking about Detroit, those were deliberately formed with African-American workers, white workers from the South, workers from the Middle East, and the whole idea was to try to keep the workforce divided. And we've seen that over and over again in American history and elsewhere. But to your point about Detroit, yes, it was fuel-efficient cars from Japan and Germany. And it was only the Japanese-looking people and people who drove Japanese cars who were attacked. So today, being able to point to people from China or people who look Chinese is a good way to distract people who are highly upset, frustrated, worried, afraid, and angry, and looking for somebody to blame. We know for people who are following the research on this that there's a whole strain, a different strain, a more virulent strain that has come from Europe and probably Italy. And that's why New York, Massachusetts, and the East Coast have been so severely affected. But nobody's talking about boycotting pizza or Italian restaurants or going to Little Italy's and trashing that or calling names or physically beating up and potentially killing people. That's just not even on the radar.
Yeah.
And so it's definitely a tool that's being used and has been used.
I wanted to ask you about this is something you've written about, and we were talking about the 1980s a moment ago, and you write about this song from the 1980s by the British band The Vapors. It's called "Turning Japanese," and you write about that in one of your books about how you were intrigued by this idea that when you heard that song, "Turning Japanese," that you could turn into, or as you put it, adopt another culture so different from your own. Would you talk a little bit about your thinking about this particular moment? Because it prompted you to ask this question, what about turning American? And the way you were thinking about it at this time, it interests me. Would you mention that, if you would?
Oh, sure. That song came out in the 80s. It was a very popular song. And I remember thinking about the song. It's also very simple, but the main lyric is "turning Japanese."
Yeah.
And the whole idea, as you point out, why are people thinking of turning Japanese when all my life I've been wondering, how do I become American in the sense of that other people will see me as American? I was born in New Jersey. I was raised, you know, with hot dogs, apple pie, baseball, and Chevrolet.
Yeah.
And I am, you know, completely culturally American, as so many Asian Americans are. And yet, there has been historically this barrier, even today, you know, when there are more than 20 million Asian Americans, people of Asian ancestry in America, some of them going back 10 generations, you know, six, seven generations, you know, me, I'm a second generation American. And still the idea is that no matter how long your people have been here and have been Americans, that if somebody sees you, they're going to go, oh, it's the virus is because of you. And so I'm going to spit on you, or I'm going to maybe kill you, and because you're not American. And that's been one of the, I guess, painful themes for people of Asian ancestry in America. And so the question is when will we be fully accepted as Americans? And I still ponder that because, you know, we go through cycles, you know, one step forward, two steps back. This Congress right now, we have the highest number of Asian American elected officials who are national leaders in Congress. That's incredible. Something I wouldn't have imagined when I was a child. But so that's progress. On the other hand, here we are. It almost feels like we're back to the 1980s when Vincent Chin, the Chinese American, was killed for looking Japanese, or even going back into the 1800s when there was the ethnic cleansing of America to get rid of every person of Asian descent out of the United States. And, you know, the first law against any particular group, the Chinese Exclusion Act, came into being. You know, it feels like we're back at that time where, you know, anybody who looks Japanese is considered a bearer of disease and needs to be exterminated. That's the kind of language we're hearing today, and it's sad.
What was it like growing up in New Jersey? That we'll talk a little bit about some of the particulars here. I know your father was a poet, an editor, a diplomat. Your mother had her own harrowing history, which I'm hoping we can spend a little bit of time with. But you grew up, as you say, in New Jersey in the third phase of Levittown.
Yes.
And so – but I have to say, you say now there's – what did you say? 20 million Asian Americans in this country right now. Let's compare it to the days when you were growing up in the 50s and 60s when there was something like only a half a million. And what was it like when your family would walk into a shop there in New Jersey?
Oh my goodness. Yes, if you can imagine less than a million Asians counted in the census in the 1950s. And the vast majority living in places like Chinatowns, little Tokyos, Manila towns, and the state of Hawaii.
Yeah.
So in a place like Levittown, New Jersey, we were anybody of Asian descent was like a Martian, like not just an alien by citizenship, an alien from outer space. And when my family would walk into a shop, you know, the supermarket, a pizza joint, every head in the place would turn to stare at us, and not in that friendly like look or like welcome. It was like, what are you doing here in my America? And so as kids, we grew up just sort of, you know, preparing ourselves to walk into the diner and knowing that people were going to stare at us. And you know, at the time there were four of us. Later there were two more, so six kids. But we developed our own little defense mechanism, which would, if people stared at us, the four of us would all, little kids, would turn and stare right back and have a staring contest. And I think of the movie Children of the Damned, where all the kids have those glowing eyeballs. Right. But for us, that was a way that we could at least say, hey, we see you staring at us and we're going to look right back at you.
Growing up, you mentioned the wars that were being fought around that time, of course, were against people who looked like you. So that must have played into that sense of being apart from the American experience for you.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, my childhood was in the 50s, and what happened in the 50s? The Korean War, you know, what happened the decade earlier? World War II and Japan and the day that will live forever in infamy. Mm-hmm. And then as I got a little older, there was the war in Vietnam. And so every one of these wars was fought in Asia with people who looked like me. And so when my siblings and I would go to the Saturday matinee with the other kids, often these would be war movies that would be showing. And of course, the enemy would be people who looked like us. And there would always be that defining moment in the war movie where the good guys, the Americans, would be, you know, bombing the smithereens or getting rid of the enemy, and the whole theater would be, you know, rising up in a crescendo, kill them, kill them, kill them. And when the lights came on, our little friends all around us would be looking at us, and we were looked just like the people who they were shouting, kill them. Or actually my town, Levittown, now named Willingboro, they changed the name, but Willingboro was very close to Fort Dix and McGuire Air Force Base. And so many of the other kids in this, you know, housing tract town had family that were part of the military. And many of my friends were, you know, Army brats. And as the Vietnam War continued, it was painful to know that some of my schoolmates might have had a brother or a family member fighting or even dying. And there were times when somebody would walk in, maybe in his fatigues, and look at me and say, oh, they're everywhere, aren't they? And I knew what that meant. That meant, you know, the enemy is here too. And watching on the news every night, the body counts of how many Vietnamese were killed that day, thousands and thousands, and feeling like they were talking about people who look like me. And it was a time of feeling very much like this is wrong. And at the same time, the civil rights movement was in full bloom. Yeah. We're talking about the 50s and 60s. There was a lot of talk about racial justice and inequality and mistreatment of African Americans. And so seeing the kind of things that were happening to my family and later, as I understood, other Asian Americans, I felt a very strong connection to the kind of things that were being said about civil rights and the humanity of all people, and that we should all be treated as human beings and not as some stereotype because I look like somebody related to a war that happened, you know, 10, 20 years ago or halfway around the world.
It's Helen Zia. She's an activist and journalist featured in Asian Americans. It's a new 5-part PBS documentary series. Part one begins on Monday night. We're going to take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
I'm Maria O'Mara, Executive Director of KUER. Thanks to everyone who donated during our recent spring fundraiser. We heard from so many of you who gave generously. If you're in a position to give during this time, please consider supporting the station today. Your gift will keep this public service strong for Utahns who rely on accurate news and information. You can give at KUER.org/donate or call 801-581-KUER. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Helen Zia is joining us. She says this recent wave of anti-Asian American racism is ugly, but nothing new in the American experience. Just think about the Japanese internment camps in World War II, or the way Chinese American laborers were practically erased from the original telling of the story of the Continental Railroad. On Monday, PBS is airing the first in a documentary series about the history of Asian Americans. Zia is featured in the film, and she's joining us today to talk about that history and her part in it. Her most recent book is Last Boat Out of Shanghai, the epic story of the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution. Helen Zia, I wanted to ask you about this story that is related in the documentary series. This idea that, and I think this seems to be the experience of your father and your mother too, is that when they experienced discrimination, they probably gritted their teeth a bit, but didn't really say anything. And the idea is that this sort of impression comes, this stereotype comes about for Asian Americans, that they just have to keep their head down, they have to be compliant, and they have to be submissive, at least at that time. Would you talk about this moment in the history?
When you think about when I was a kid in the 50s, there were less than a million, maybe 800,000 Asian Americans. And before that, even fewer. And Asian Americans could not be citizens of the United States. We could not get naturalized. If we somehow made it into the U.S., we could not become a citizen to vote until 1952.
Wow.
So when people look and say, well, how come Asian Americans are so quiet, or why are they not so involved in politics, or I just don't see them in the same way as other racial groups, partly is because we were barred from doing it. And people had good reason for thinking that if they stuck out too much, if you're the nail that sticks out, you get hammered down. That was the saying that people grew up hearing. Don't stick out, you will suffer for it. And the reason that was is because they did.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned the internment of Japanese Americans. That was a shameful period of American history where everybody off the west coast of the United States who was of Japanese ancestry, including children who were American citizens, were uprooted, moved, and incarcerated for some up to 4 years. They lost everything.
There's another experience that the documentary talks about. It's when China, when Mao Zedong takes power in China, and the country, once an ally, becomes an enemy. And this, of course, affects American perceptions of Asian Americans, of Chinese Americans. You know, the question of whether they're truly loyal to the U.S. Chinese men only allowed to have jobs that don't threaten white men. Just talk a little bit about, again, this other wave of discrimination that plays out in the story.
This suspicion of not being American, whether it was during World War II and a person of Japanese ancestry, even children who were born here and were American citizens, were suspected of being spies. Or potential, you know, fifth column in America. And so, you know, 120,000 people were moved inland, uprooted, and incarcerated, imprisoned for the duration of the war, 4 years. And so that idea of, you know, as you pointed out, whiplash, suddenly Chinese become the enemy and Japanese Americans are held up as good citizens. Because they learn the lesson, don't be the nail that sticks up, you'll get hammered down. So the generation of Japanese Americans who came out of those American concentration camps were very much oriented to just blend in and raise as little of a voice as possible. And so for Chinese in America, you know, that lesson wasn't missed either, because Japanese or Chinese people assumed you were whatever the enemy was. Chinese during World War II had buttons that said, I'm not Japanese, I'm Chinese. But for many people, it didn't matter. Just like today, it doesn't matter whether somebody's
Chinese American, they're still going to be accused and mistreated because they're associated with this virus. Well, and so when I was a kid, my father, in the 1950s, during the McCarthy era, when China was being held up as the, one of the dominoes that was going to fall and turn America communist, my father told my mother, don't speak Chinese to the children.
Yeah.
Because if we learn to speak Chinese, that we might face discrimination. And I have to say, I regret that my father ever said that to my mother, because then I would have another language to speak. But he did it out of concern. And a lot of Chinese American parents felt the same way. Just, let's see what happened to the Japanese Americans. Let's not let that happen to us. And yeah. And there were FBI incursions into Chinatowns. There were, my father had an FBI record because he spoke up. He said many times, he was an outspoken guy, and he would, if he saw something that he thought was wrong, he would speak up about it. He would write letters to the editor. He even wrote a pamphlet saying that the U.S. policy toward China was wrong. That earned him an FBI record. And our little neighbor kids would say to us when we were playing, on the street, hey, what does your father do? The FBI came to our house and asked about him. So we knew that we were being surveilled, and we weren't the only ones. It was really a whole period of time when people of Chinese descent were being getting special surveillance. And Doug, I have to say that's been going on now and for the last couple of decades to people of Chinese descent, because the growing economy of China, the rise of China as a potential superpower, has also meant increasing negative attention in a way where Chinese Americans are getting arrested or accused falsely, being imprisoned falsely. And so where we are today, in a way, is looking at a place where the pump has been primed. People have been hearing negative things about China, China, China for quite a long time, especially from this president, and using the powers of his administration to really smoke people of Chinese background for quite some time. And unfortunately for every Asian American, there's an assumption that we're all the same. And that's so completely idiotic. But, 20 million people who reflect, a huge number of the world's population can't possibly be the same. But so to the extent that people of Chinese background in America have been targeted now and for the past several years, that really bodes very badly for every Asian American.
Helen Z, I'm trying to figure out where your sense of activism comes. It seems like you could say from your father to some degree, as you say, he was an outspoken person at times. He was a newspaper editor. He was a diplomat, as I said. He wrote poetry. He wanted you. You've written about in your book, Asian American Dreams, you've written about the fact that he wanted you to know about your heritage. But you also talk about being shy. You also saw these, you had these experiences of discrimination yourself. Where did your sense of activism come from, if you can peg it?
Well, sure. I have to say that I was, I think, very fortunate to grow up in the period of time of the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
From African-American communities were standing up for the cause of their humanity and equality, and also the anti-war movement, where it was a whole generation, especially of young people, saying, hell no, we won't go. What is this we're supposed to be putting our lives on the line for? And that was a mass youth movement, as well as the women's liberation movement. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on there and an incipient gay liberation movement.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of examples around me, you know, for really my generation, which said that if you see something in the world that you don't like, you change, you have an obligation to speak up and change it. And so for me, it was one step at a time. I was a very shy kid. I grew up in an environment that was that weird Martian, you know, that lived from another universe, and people didn't want me around, and that made me quiet. But when I saw that, really, what's the alternative? To stay quiet like a little mouse and see things going on around me that I knew were wrong and do nothing, or to try to do something about it and try to speak up? And I think I took that lesson to heart from everything I saw around me. And one thing about social change and speaking up, that you find out that, you know what, the earth doesn't open up, the swallow you, a thunderbolt doesn't come out of the sky and strike down, a big hammer doesn't come and knock you down. But in fact, you can speak up, and sometimes change really does happen. And that is very empowering, and I think I was, that's where I got my inspiration from, the, you know, the activists in the world that came beyond before me, and then seeing that, you know what, maybe I can do something too.
You tell the story in your book about a friend of yours named Rose, and this was during the turmoil of the civil rights movement, where you were really engaged at that time. And she says to you at some point, "Helen, you've got to decide if you're black or white." What did that mean?
Right. Oh, well, that was devastating in a way. It was, as I said, I grew up during the civil rights movement, and there were conversations about civil rights going on in every school, every public place. You know, it was in the news all the time. And in my high school, we had walkouts, we had sit-ins, we had teach-ins to talk about, you know, what is the civil rights movement? What does racial equality mean? You know, what is this world that we imagine where we will be viewed only by the content of our character and not the color of our skin? Those were conversations we had. And so one day we had a walkout, and all of the kids in the high school were out in the schoolyard, the parking lot, waiting to be called back in, and in the meantime having these conversations. And I remember very clearly that spring day with two friends, Susan and Julie. One was white and one was black. There I was, Asian kid, yellow kid, and we were talking. And Rose looked at me and said, "Well, you know, Helen, you know, I was talking about my dreams of a different kind of society. Helen, you've got to decide whether you're black or white." And I it stopped me cold, because, you know, of course I could live myself, and I knew I'm not black and I'm not white, but where did I stand in America then? And in a way that was a very direct way of being the query that Asian Americans find themselves in back then, and I would even say today, which is that we have for so long been seen and defined only in relation black or white, and now today we might say black, brown, or white, you know, but back then it was black or white, and so you're kind of seen as somewhere in the middle. But if you want to talk about race in America, which was the issue of the day, and or any issue about America, you've got to decide whether you're black or white. And in other words, you can't have your own voice. You can't have your self-definition or self-determination. It's all in relation to this other. And so I think that's been quite a challenge. And for Asian Americans today, still being able to define ourselves as not being the evil enemy, diabolical alien or virus to destroy America, or the other side of that coin is to be the model minority, the good, passive, you know, coolie, the Asian step and fetch it, who will do anything and work hard for the master and never speak up because they might get hammered down. Those are the two definitions that we've had imposed on us. But part of the challenge today is for now to 20 million Asian Americans to be able to break through this and to create our own definitions of who we are. And, you know, more we stop, the better. And I feel that, you know, that's partly what my life has been about, to stand up and say, no, I'm not that thing you think.
Yeah.
This is who I am. I'm a whole human being.
Helen Zia, I wanted to ask you, you have this experience, you have multiple opportunities to be discriminated against. I guess I'll put it that way. A woman in the 50s and 60s, a Chinese American, there's that, but also being gay. And I wondered, how did the experience of being gay, how did that compound this experience? How did it complicate your own personal story and involvement in all of this?
Well, we are all complex beings because we are human, and there's just none of us in one dimension. But what happens is, for example, talking about race, is a conversation about race, how do we also talk about sexism there or about homophobia? And during the Vincent Chin case, is it possible for me to be an activist talking about racism to Americans and hate crimes? And then for people to look at me and for me to talk about, oh, and by the way, I'm a lesbian too, when at the time the homophobia was so strong that within my own racial communities, the communities I lived in, the friends I didn't know whether they would have homophobia and want to shun me, because actually I have had experiences there within my fellow activist groups of African American and Asian American activists who said there was no place for a gay person in our community. There was no homosexuality among African Americans or Asian Americans, something that is like, how ridiculous that anybody would think that. But at the time, because the invisibility of really of all queer people, because of homophobia, there was people were closeted and afraid to come out. But in a way, for me and my activism, it became, as much as I wanted to speak out as an Asian American and talk about the rape we faced, or as a woman and as a feminist to talk about sexism in our society and violence against women, there came a time where it was really imperative that gay men and lesbian and queer people would speak up and say, you know what, we're in your communities, we're in your families, we have families, we have people we love too, and we might be your cousin, your brother, your sister, your aunt, your uncle, your children, and so don't think that we don't exist in your community. So in a way, for me, it's all been a parallel path, I guess, where a convergence, you know, people use words like intersectionality, but every one of us, every human being, represents intersectionality, because none of us is just one little checkbox. We are all, you know, multiple, have multiple facets, and our ability to see that in ourselves and each other, to see the full humanity that we have, is what I hope, you know, can bring us to recognize that and bring us together. You know, so my family, my mother and father were immigrants. You know, the majority of Asians in America, about 60 to 70%, are here as immigrants. Well, everybody in America, an immigrant story, except, of course, your Native American. But if people could remember that whiteness is not all one thing, or being African American has many different countries and backgrounds and cultures and so forth as well. And if we can, even though, of course, African Americans, you know, history wasn't an immigration story. It was forcibly being brought here and enslaved. But my point is, people have come from other places. And if we can kind of understand that in our own communities, it might make us more compassionate to parents who are here struggling to reunite with their kids who are being imprisoned today. And separated from their family. So anyway, your question about these different paths or, quote, separate identities or whatever that are not so separate, but intersectional identities, for me, I think that's really true for everybody. And really, if we can find those points of commonality, that's what's going to move us forward.
I wanted to, you mentioned the story of Vincent Chin, and I wanted to just say something, have you say something about that for those who are unfamiliar with the story. It's one that's featured in the documentary as well, and you were involved in that story, covered it as a journalist, were engaged in it. You had this really interesting part of another interesting part of the story of your life, moving to Detroit in the 1970s, wanting to be part of the labor movement, getting a job as a factory worker, losing your job when that oil crisis comes, and then you being a witness to all of that anti-Japanese discrimination that plays out at the time. So let's talk about what happens to Vincent Chin. He's a 27-year-old Chinese American. He's mistaken for a Japanese American, and he's basically beaten to death. This was in 1982. This was an important story, sort of as a turning point in the Asian American story in some ways. Would you just say something about this story?
Oh, absolutely. And sadly, it has a lot of parallels to what's going on today. But I, you know, got a job in a Chrysler stamping plant. I worked there for 2 years before with the oil crisis that led to the collapse of not only the auto industry, but the entire manufacturing sector of America. I stood in unemployment lines that snaked around several city blocks for people just to see, you know, if they could get something to pay the rent after being laid off from jobs that were among the highest paying jobs in the country. For blue collar and labor, and so I understood very well the suffering that people were going through, because I was too, and the frustration that led to being able to believe and get swept up in a tide of racism, because when you are so miserable and suffering so much, you want to take that anger and frustration out on somebody. Somebody is to blame. And so when this finger of racism and blame landed on Japan because they made fuel-efficient cars, and of course we talked about it didn't land on Germany, but it landed on Japan because people looked different and could be identified as different, that large swaths of people were hoodwinked and fell victim to the poison of racism. And they then, unfortunately for Vincent Chin, on his bachelor party a few days before his wedding, went out to celebrate his upcoming wedding with some friends. And because Chinese American Vincent Chin looked Japanese, these two white auto workers looked at him and said, "It's because of you MFs that we're out of work." And that led to, you know, a fight that carried out into the street, and the two white auto workers pulled out a baseball bat, caught up with Vincent and his Chinese friend, not with his other friends who were white, but chased after the Chinese men, and caught up with Vincent Chin, grabbed them in a bear hug hold, and one of them held them down. The other took four swings with his bat like he was going for a home run to Vincent Chin's head. And his head was split open that night. The EMT people who came later said, "I knew he was a goner. His brains were on the street." Wow. And that was emblematic of the racism, the intensity of the racism at the time, but it forced Asian Americans, who were separate ethnic groups. I mean, there was no Asian American movement then, of you know, communities of people coming together to say, you know, we are united to stand up against this kind of racism. But that's what happened with the Vincent Chin case. People came together. And Asian Americans also then joined with African Americans, Arab Americans, you know, people of every religion, the Jewish Anti-Defamation League, to then create a movement to make change, and made many, many changes that affected every American for the better. And I think that's something else we could learn from that time, that that's what it's going to take, all of us coming together to defeat the challenges that we have today.
That's the activist and journalist Helen Zia. You can see her in the new PBS documentary Asian Americans, which starts on Monday night on PBS stations around the country. You can see it at 7 o'clock on PBS Utah. Helen Zia, thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you, Doug. My pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.